Someone had turned the music on to... what was that? 80s rock? I supposed my birthday got a reprieve from the country music so preferred in Alamette County. We ate. Someone had been kind enough to make grilled chicken and provide salad fixings in addition to the standard artery-clogging cookout fare, and drank and shot the shit. Jimmy Bob Prosser made an appearance, presenting me with a gift certificate for his hardware store and a stolen kiss on the cheek from my mother before he left. She beamed after him, and I found myself unable to be anything but happy for her. Now, if the guy went and broke her heart, I'd be enlisting my brothers for some bootleg justice. It was only fair. A pickup bounced down the driveway and pulled into the grass next to Gibson's SUV. Jameson and Leah May, both beaming brighter than the sun, linked hands and strolled our way. I nudged Bowie next to me, pointed my beer bottle.
"Well, well, here come the soon-to-be newly engaged," Bowie observed.
Jameson's imminent proposal plans were still cloaked in mystery, but it made my day even brighter knowing that another brother was marching happily toward his future. George and Shelby's parents were enthusiastic about the chaos and made plans to attend Tuesday's Cockspurs game. Devlin stepped in when Scarlett batted her lashes and tried to recruit them to the team. He'd fallen for it once before and paid a very steep hangover price. When evening fell and the string lights twinkled on, Mom and Shelby marched out a cake with sparklers and candles. The Bodine serenaded me with the worst off-key rendition of Happy Birthday I'd ever heard in my life. Little Billy Ray howled along with them. It was awful and beautiful. I laughed and smiled, ate and drank. Embarrassed, I opened gifts, both gag and thoughtful, and I watched Shelby at the opposite end of the table. I caught her eye, and the slow, sweet smile on her face warmed something in me that had been cold for too long. And then I took an elbow to the gut.
"Looks like someone took his pants off today."
Scarlett grinned up at me, a cat that ate the canary. "I don't kiss and tell," I said, slinging an arm around her shoulder.
"No, but you kiss and moon around with puppy dog eyes. She's a nice girl, Jonah. I approve."
"You practically picked her out for me. I should hope you'd approve," I teased.
"Now listen, I know this is all new to you, but y'all should probably define exactly what this is, because news will be all over town by tomorrow."
"You mean you're going to open your big fat mouth and tell everyone in town that I'm dating Shelby?" I corrected her.
"Dating, huh? I can get behind that."
"Even if it's none of your business?"
"Why, Jonah Bodine, you're my brother. Your happiness is my business."
"Just don't start any wedding plans, Scar. Shelby doesn't plan to stick around past the end of the summer."
"What about you?"
she asked.
"And before you even think about answering, you better not be considering leaving. Why, I brought your mama all the way out here to make her fall in love with this town."
"You're a diabolical puppet master, Scarlet Rose." She beamed up at me.
"If it's a crime to want my family to be happy and all together, then put me on death row."
"You're ridiculous."
"I found my happily ever after," she said, eyes flying to where Devlin and Jameson were deep in discussion. "Jameson and Leah May, Bowie and Cassidy, they found theirs, too. You can have a good life here."
I nodded. "I know it, but I'm just not 1,000% sure yet."
"Well, you'll have more incentive once I get your mama married off and moved in here,"
she predicted. As darkness fell, I noticed Bowie sneak off toward the shadows to take a phone call. I could see the tension in his shoulders, and something told me it wasn't good news.
I excused myself from the table where James and Darlene were recounting one of their recent home renovation horror stories to Scarlett, who insisted that the next time they needed some plumbing done, they call her first. Bowie was standing there, staring down at his phone when I got to him. "What's wrong?" I asked. He looked up, and I knew. "Fuck," I said quietly. It was Jamie. Dental records were a match. It's Callie. Behind us, laughter erupted as Gibson and Jameson vied to tell my mom about their attempt at ice fishing when they were kids. "This doesn't change anything," I said, knowing full well that it changed everything. Callie Kendall was dead, and so were the hopes of an entire community. "It doesn't mean that Dad did it," Bowie said, sounding even less confident than me. "No, it doesn't. Jamie says they're keeping the news under wraps for a few days." I watched my mom dab tears of laughter from the corners of her eyes with a napkin. Now Scarlett was slow dancing with Devlin, looking up at him like he was the sun and the moon and everything in between. Shelby was leaning into her father's arm, laughing at some story he was telling June. "Let's not ruin this," I said. "Everyone's having a good time. I'd rather keep it that way for another night." It was selfish, but there wasn't anything any of us could do about poor Callie Kendall, and this was my first family birthday party ever. Bowie squeezed my shoulder. "Happy birthday, brother." "Yeah, thanks."
33. All of Bootleg Springs.
"Did y'all hear the news? Course we heard already. Such a shame. I always thought that that Cali girl was traveling in Canada with one of them there acrobatic acts. I always figured she was dead. May she rest in peace, of course. Why's that? She ain't never come back, did she? How you think the Kendalls are handling the news? Doesn't seem like it's a surprise to them. They always figured she was dead and gone. Seemed right sure of it. I heard they was planning the funeral private. Don't want a bunch of looky-loos poking their noses around the church and cemetery. What about the Bodines?
What about them?
Does this mean Jonah Sr., and may he rest in peace, killed her? Hell if I know. With him dead and gone, rest in peace, I figure we'll never know what happened to that poor girl.
I reckon Jonah Sr. did it. Who else would have?
What about that no-account Lester McCoy from over yonder in Hollersville? That sumbitch would put a rattlesnake in your pocket and ask for a light. You know, my Millie was a year younger than that Callie. I didn't let her leave my side for a year after that girl up and got herself killed. Everyone was hugging their kids extra tight after that. And to think she's been dead this whole time. I hoped she'd gone off to Hollywood and got herself a star on that Walk of Fame.
You know they pay for those, don't you?
The hell you say.
It's the God's honest truth. I was watching under the red carpet, and they said how's the celebrity gets themselves nominated and then coughs up 30 grand. Wham, bam, presto, they got their own star.
That takes some of the fun out of it, don't it?
Sure does. I stopped hoping Callie Kendall would get a star after I found out all about it. Still sad, though.
Quite the roller coaster. One minute she's missing, then there's this bloody sweater and she's dead, then along comes that faker girl. What was her name?
Dunno. Fake Callie's what we call around the dinner table. Along comes fake Callie, and we all bust out to celebration, thinking she's alive and well. Now this. I gotta say, this feels like a letdown.
How you think the Bodines are feeling today? I'm hoping they're feeling right guilty. That's a terrible thing to say. Why should they feel guilty? Well, their daddy done did it, didn't he? No one knows for sure. The evidence is there. In my mind, Jonah Bodine Sr., may he rest in peace, was a drunk and a murderer.
I, for one, don't agree with the whole sins of the father bullshit you're selling. That's like saying you should be responsible for your papa causing Mott's heart attack when they got in that hollering fit over at the lookout 20 years ago.
That wasn't Pop's fault. Mott was the one who got all uppity about his bingo card.
Still, I don't think it's fair that people are looking to point the finger at those Bodine kids. They're just as much victims, ain't they? How y'all figure? They grew up with Connie and Jonah. May they rest in peace. For parents, them kids are lucky they didn't come out more screwed up. I bet that Jonah Jr. will be moving on now. If he does, it's because old biddies like you telling everyone he's the son of a murderer. I'm just speaking my truth. You're speaking bullshit. There's a difference. Speaking of Jonah Jr., did you hear that he's dating that sweetheart Shelby Thompson? Well, ain't that nice? I heard he showed up at Spring Sundries and bought out just about everything in the bass section for her, put together a real nice gift basket. Well, I heard that she went to Build-A-Shine and made herself up a recipe called Bootleg Boot Camp. Obviously, she was poking fun at him for being hungover after the moonshine tasting. Oh, for sure. It's damn adorable. They're all puffed up about not being serious and about moving on at the end of the summer. But a lot can happen in one summer. Question. What is your most reliable source for community news? Cassidy Tucker. A 5-minute walk down the street with your ears open. 34. Shelby. With a few notable differences, the Bootleg Springs Community Library was just like every other small-town library. Its book stacks were neatly organized in rows containing hundreds of volumes on everything from classical poetry to farmers' almanacs. The children's nook was too noisy, and the whole building smelled like furniture polish and old books. Where it differed from most other libraries was in the people and the services. The head librarian, Piper Redman, was a pink, pixie-haired walking billboard for piercings and tattoos. She was painfully cool. Literacy rates were on the rise just because she made reading look so darn cool. She'd built programs not just around story hours and book clubs, but expanded community services. There was a volunteer squad of tech support teens who every weekend walked some of Bootleg's less tech-savvy residents through problems with their mobile devices. Then there was the free weekday shuttle that picked up elderly residents and brought them in to socialize and volunteer. And, of course, the monthly spaghetti dinner, the proceeds of which went toward new books, better computers, and more comfortable reading chairs. In an age when community libraries were struggling for funding and, in some cases, relevancy, Bootleg's library was thriving. There was also an extensive local history section, which I was in the process of devouring. I'd started out with good intentions. Jonah and my brother were off doing some fat-busting boot camp for 2 hours today. I planned to use the time to put together a timeline of defining events in town history. But when I walked through the front door, the community bulletin board was different. There was no missing flyer of Callie Kendall where it always was. I'd guessed that flyer, or one like it, had been at the top of that bulletin board since the girl disappeared. That made it even sadder, in my opinion. The surrendering of 13 years of hope. I pretended it didn't matter and settled into the matter at hand. But in my cursory search of local newspapers on microfiche, I came across an article about the Kendalls after Callie's disappearance. And then another. And another. The disappearance had helped shape the community, I rationalized. I'd be doing a disservice by ignoring the tear that moment and the years that followed had ripped in the town's fabric. An hour, I decided. I'd spare an hour and do a little digging into the Kendalls. Then I'd go back to my own work. The microfiche blurred before my eyes as I consumed article after article about the disappearance, the family statements, the investigation. It was interesting that the Kendalls had never wavered from their claim that their daughter was dead, had harmed herself. Not until fake Callie came onto the scene. I called up a photo of Callie and another of fake Callie. There was a resemblance, I thought, squinting at the screen, but more of a "you remind me of a girl I knew" way. The more I looked, the less fake Callie looked like real Callie. And that bothered me.
Wouldn't her parents have known, if not by physical appearance, then by gaps in the imposter's knowledge of family history? How had fake Callie convinced the Kendalls that she was their long-lost daughter? They'd rented an apartment for her in Philadelphia, far away from their home, even farther from Bootleg Springs. I drummed my fingers on my lips. If they'd believed fake Callie's story, wouldn't they have wanted to be close? To make up for all those lost years? The parents had seemingly given up hope of ever seeing their daughter alive again from the beginning, despite the lack of evidence. Wouldn't they have been overjoyed that she was still alive and reaching out to them? Nothing about the situation sat right with me. A thought fluttered in, took root. On a whim, I pulled out my phone and ducked outside. It was hotter today. July arrived in a matter of days. The town was already decorating for the 4th. Swathing everything that didn't move in red, white, and blue bunting. Opting for the shade, I walked down the library steps and took a seat on a bench under a yet-to-be-swathed oak. I dialed, waited. "Shelby Thompson, what are you doing on the other end of my phone?" My old friend and former supervisor from Allegheny County Children, Youth, and Families demanded. "I'm doing a little research down here in the great state of West Virginia, Amanda, and I could use a hand with something. Name it, sweetie." Amanda had been my supervisor during my brief tenure as a social worker in Pittsburgh. She'd even come to the hospital's emergency department the night my career came to its disastrous end. "Do you still have friends at the state level in Virginia?" I asked. "Sure do." I could hear the click of her fingers on the keyboard as she multitasked. CYF's to-do list was never caught up. "I was wondering if you could have them do a quick case search for me." "What county?" Amanda asked. I screwed up my nose, knowing this was the big part of the ask. "All of them," I said. Amanda blew out a breath. "It'll take a while." Counties had their own databases for managing children and youth cases. There was no central database connecting them, which made looking for information tedious and time-consuming. "I know, and I really appreciate it. It's important," I promised. "Give me the names, and I'll see if I can have something for you next week. Judge Henry Kendall, Mrs. Imogen Kendall, and Callie Kendall." "Oh, boy. Sounds like you're down there kicking a hornet's nest," she sighed. "I don't think there's going to be anything. If there was, the police would have already looked into it. I just want to be certain." "Just don't go stirring things up by pointing fingers at a state judge." "He might not be a state judge for long," I told her. "Word has it, our Judge Kendall is first in line for a federal judge appointment." News traveled fast, especially news that bootleggers could brag about. "Our Judge Kendall finally being recognized for his years of service. A federal judge? Imagine that." "Well, that happens," Amanda said, and I could tell she was getting distracted by the dozens of other tasks that required her attention. I gave her the date ranges to check, which posed an additional problem since some of the records from the earlier years still weren't electronic, and promised to email her an update about what I was doing in rural West Virginia for the summer. We hung up, and I stared, unseeing, across Main Street into the lakefront park where families picnicked and swam. I couldn't shake the feeling that there was something sinister happening in Bootleg Springs. "Shelby?" I jumped a mile, wincing when my shoulder, which had been a little tender this morning, burst into flames of fresh pain. Dang it. I needed some anti-inflammatory stat. "Jenny! Hi. You startled me," I told her, pressing a hand over my pounding heart. I didn't like being snuck up on. Had never gotten over the trigger for that particular fear. Jonah's mother looked pretty and fresh in shorts and a button-down blouse the color of summer skies. "Sorry about that. I was just on my way to meet someone, and I saw you." The way her cheeks pinked at the mention of someone, I wondered if it was Jimmy Bob Prosser. She was headed in the direction of the hardware store, I noted. "I was on the phone and didn't hear you," I said. "I hope you don't mind, but I overheard a bit of your conversation. I understand where the interest comes from. It's a fascinating case. But it's closed now. They found her body. What are you expecting to find that law enforcement missed?" "I'm sure investigators have done their due diligence," I assured her. "I'm just curious. It's a flashy story with a lot of shiny information for a researcher like me to play with. That's all." Jenny sat down on the bench next to me. "Men like Judge Kendall have the kind of power that others easily underestimate. Don't forget that. Don't underestimate him." It sounded less like friendly advice and more like a warning. And she wanted me to hear it, abide by it. "Do you know him?" I asked. She shrugged, and the corners of her mouth lifted as she watched a pair of grandparents corral their three grandchildren on the sidewalk. "Everyone knows people like him," she said vaguely. "Don't underestimate them, and don't do something that could be misconstrued as a threat. Men like that guard their power and their reputations fiercely." "Like I said, I'm sure there's nothing to find," I said lightly. "Good. I'd like to think that my son's casual summer fling is careful." "You heard the news," I said. I wondered if I'd ever had the "so you are engaging in sex with my son" conversation before. "I think Scarlett took out a billboard," Jenny said with an easy smile. "My son is a good man, and I think you'll treat him right. So don't expect any interference from me, no matter how much I'd like to see him married and happy and to have a few grandkids on my lap." The woman had said no interference, but she hadn't meant no pressure. "Speaking of dating," I said, changing the subject to something a little safer, "you should probably tell me who you're meeting for lunch so I can do my duty as a temporary bootlegger and spread the gossip." We chit-chatted like two old friends for a few minutes until Jenny said she had to go. She was looping her purse over her shoulder when she stopped again. "You haven't seen Gibson around lately, have you?" she asked. I frowned, thinking. "No, not since Jonah's party." She said. "Why?" I asked. "I was just wondering how he was taking the news that the body they found was Callie Kendall. I hope all the Bodines are doing okay," she added quickly. "They're all probably just waiting to see what will happen next, but their father's still a person of interest," I guessed. Jenny pursed her lips and nodded. "Well, you have a nice day. Be safe, Shelby. My son likes you a lot." There it was again, that vague warning that gave me a little shiver up the spine.
35. Jonah. 10 more burpees, I said, dropping down into a push-up position. "I really fucking hate you right now," George groaned next to me. "No, you don't. You hate that you have to go through this," I said, gritting my teeth through the push-up and hopping back on my feet. "That too, and burpees. I fucking loathe burpees," he said, climbing to his feet. "Where's that jumping clap?" I was practically begging to get punched in the face, but training George, a professional athlete, was pretty freaking awesome. The man's strength was circus freak level, and his muscle had already burned off 6 unwanted pounds since we started working together. He gave a lackluster bounce on his toes, a sloppy clap. 9 more. Let's go." "I could punch you for these, or the fact that you're sleeping with my sister and didn't tell me," he wheezed. "Yeah, you could," I agreed. "I want points for my self-control," George said, eyeing me before dropping down to the ground again. "Consider points awarded." We bitched and busted our way through them, and when it was over, we both lay down in the grass. chugging water and swiping sweat out of our eyes.
You're meaner than any trainer I had when I played, he complained.
They have to be nice to you in the league. Can't have a bunch of 300-pound babies crying about drills and sit-ups.
So, you and my sister, George said, picking up the thread I'd let drop.
Yeah, I said.
As long as you're good to her, I won't plow my fists into your face, he said.
Understood. I sat up, grabbed a foam roller, and tossed it to him.
Here, this will help you hate me less in the morning.
He leaned forward and rubbed at the scars on his leg. One bad tendon had brought his career to a screeching halt.
I gotta ask Shelby what she used on her scars to help them heal, he muttered.
I remembered the scar on her chest, the jagged one on her leg. How did she get them? I asked. I'd noticed them, but their origin had never come up in conversation. He studied me.
She doesn't like to talk about it, he said, taking another swig of water before shoving the foam roller under his hamstrings.
For a minute, I thought that would be the end of it.
Since you're sleeping with her, living with her, I'd feel better if you knew. Sometimes she still has nightmares about it.
Despite the heat, the sweat, the hair on my arms stood up.
This was back when she was fresh out of college. A family Shelby was working with called her one night, late. They had a lot of issues, but the main one was their teenage son. Big son of a bitch. Unstable. More than just impulse control shit. He'd taken a shine to Shelby. She could get through to him sometimes when others couldn't, but he kept going off his meds,
George said, swiping a hand over his face.
He'd show up at her favorite coffee shop, the grocery store in her neighborhood. She made light of it, like it was no big deal.
I felt the tension in him as he recalled it.
She didn't listen to me. I was the overprotective big brother. She had it all under control. She just wanted to help.
That sounds like Shelby, I said.
He nodded. She cares too much, thinks she can fix everything, and there are just some things, some people, you can't fix.
He rubbed his palms together slowly as he worked through his memories.
One night, he showed up at her apartment. She didn't let him in, and he tried to kick in the door until one of the neighbors called the cops.
Shit, I said, clenching my fists.
Yeah, her supervisor reassigned her. They'd seen shit like this before. The kid was obsessing. He'd do things just to get Shelby to show up at his place. Anything for her attention. So they tried to take her out of the equation, assign the family to a guy social worker.
How did Shelby feel about it? I asked. George shrugged.
She keeps stuff private a lot. She doesn't like people worrying about her, but from what I could gather, she thought she failed him. Like somehow she should have convinced him to stay on his meds. They helped when he took them, but he'd forget, or he'd pretend to take them, and then he'd just lose control.
He got up and paced restlessly now, a brother who loved his sister. I wondered how I'd feel if someone tried to hurt Scarlett. The wave of raw anger, fear, was instinctive.
Anyway, one night, the mother called Shelby in a panic. He continued. The son had chased her and the rest of the kids into a bedroom with a kitchen knife. They were locked in, and he was kicking and punching at the door.
Why didn't she call the cops? I asked, dreading the resolution of the story.
Didn't want her son to get taken away. Shelby knew that. She told the mom to hang tight, she'd handle it.
I closed my eyes, took a breath.
So she goes over there.
Alone?
I interrupted. He nodded. Like the innocent do-gooder she was. The past tense got me. He was waiting for her. His mom told him through the door that Shelby was coming to help him. She knocked on the damn door, but it was already open. George rubbed a hand over his mouth, taking a moment. It was dark inside. My hands were clenched again. I crossed my arms over my chest and waited for the words he didn't want to say, the story I didn't want to hear. She walked in, all by herself. He came at her with the knife. They struggled. He got in a lucky swipe or two, the whole time screaming about how he loves her and they're going to be together. But his grip slipped because of the blood. She started to run, and she either tripped or he pushed her, but she took a header down the stairs. Jesus, I muttered. You know her, George said with a ghost of a smile. Odds are she tripped over her own feet. Yeah, odds are. Anyway, another tenant, because everyone was in the hallway now calling 911, picked her up and carried her into his apartment. Another couple of them confronted the kid, got the knife away from him, held him down until the cops came. Meanwhile, Shelby's texting me and my parents all like, "Don't freak out, but I'm heading to the hospital." I could picture it. What my idiot sister didn't tell us is that kid nicked her femoral artery and she almost bled out in a stranger's apartment. By the time I flew in and my parents got there, she'd had a transfusion or two and was all smiles. Looked like that fucking vampire from the Twilight movie. So damn pale, insisting that she was fine. What happened to the kid? I asked. He was 16. He went into a juvie mental facility. I kept an eye on the court proceedings. He was charged as a minor, sealed record. So he's just out there now? I was horrified. His family moved out of state. When he got out at 18, he moved with them. Shelby had moved too by that time. Different apartment, new neighborhood, better security. She decided to go back to school and get her doctorate. I think she just wanted to find a different way to help people, he confessed. Like it scared her bad enough that she couldn't work one-on-one with clients anymore. Moving into research made us all feel better. Smart girl, I said. That's why she's not on social media. You never thought it was weird that our little social scientist isn't on Facebook or Instagram? I hadn't given it much thought, hadn't thought to ask. She cares too much and worries too little, George said. The whole thing scared the hell out of me and our parents. She ever talk about it? I asked, thinking about her diagnosis, her reluctance to discuss it. He shook his head. I think she thinks she's past it, but you'll see that fear every once in a while if something startles her. I'd seen it and written it off. Brave girl, I said. The bravest. Sometimes I wish she weren't so brave. That she didn't think she had to handle everything on her own. She was always big on proving herself, and after seeing how worried we were when she was attacked, well, she'd probably never willingly tell us anything again. We hovered and smothered, did the family thing. And that explained a lot, but it sure as hell didn't excuse her for shutting out the family that loved her. Well, she's safe here. She's got you, me, and an entire town of weirdos ready to back her up. I said lightly, but I meant it. I didn't know exactly what was happening between the two of us, but I was invested enough to make sure she never had to face that fear again.
36. Shelby. The lake was bathwater warm, but I sure as hell wasn't lounging in it. No, I was dragging my butt through it like it was molasses and I was a wrecking ball. Something grabbed my ankle and I shrieked under the surface. I surfaced, sputtering.
Shelby, honey, you gotta pull your face out of the water every once in a while. You don't have gills,
Jonas said calmly as he tread water next to me. I got a good grip on his muscled shoulder and held on for dear life. Purposely depriving myself of oxygen while traveling through water that I could have easily crossed in a boat was stupid. Who invented triathlons anyway? How far did I go? I gasped, spitting out another mouthful of fishy lake water. I was swimming off Scarlet's dock.
100 yards or so?
Jonah gauged. We'd been working on speed to break up the monotony of the endurance workouts. He'd been yelling instructions from the end of the dock until I apparently stopped listening. He was shirtless, just the way I liked him. I tried to take a peek beneath the lake's surface to see if he'd lost his shorts, too.
You're doing great, he said. You just need to pull up more often. The more oxygen you get, the better you'll feel in the water.
You jumped in here just to tell me that? I asked, still breathing heavily. I wanted to try winking at him, but there was too much water on my eyelashes and I ended up just blinking fast. His eyes warmed as they skimmed my body beneath the surface.
Maybe I had a few other thoughts I wanted to share with you, he said.
I would very much like to hear those thoughts, I said, trailing a finger over his shoulder. Was there anything sexier than a smiling, turned-on Jonah Bodine? I was willing to do some research, but I had a feeling it wasn't necessary. Have you ever gone skinny dipping? I asked suddenly. He grinned at me, and my bikini bottoms got unrealistically wetter.
Not since my wayward teenage years. And let me tell you, jetty beach water isn't nearly as warm as this lake.
You know, if we weren't swimming off your sister's dock, I'd dare you to skinny dip with me. I let my fingers take a wet little stroll up his chest and over his shoulder. He grabbed my hand, brought my fingers to his mouth, and sucked.
Gah!
I forgot to tread water and went under. Laughing, he pulled me back to the surface. We both looked back at Scarlett's house. It was awfully close to the water, and Devlin's SUV was parked in the driveway. So much for a skinny-dipping fantasy.
Let's focus on what we're here to do, he suggested, reaching beneath the surface and skimming fingers over the bottom edge of my bikini.
I grabbed onto his shoulders to keep my head above water. His eyes were watchful, sharp, as I wrapped my legs loosely around his waist. I like swimming better than running, I confessed. His finger traced over my folds through the bathing suit bottom. My legs trembled. And I like this better than swimming, he grinned.
If we weren't in full view of my sister's house, he sighed.
What about those hot springs everyone's always talking about? I asked, sliding in for a wet kiss.
You mean the secret hot springs that only the residents know about? Jonah teased.
I mean the hot springs where my brother met June and she asked him if he was masturbating.
He winced. I really don't want to think about what other people do in the springs.
But we could be doing it too, I said, looping my arms around his neck.
I tell you what, after you finish your triathlon, I'll take you to the hot springs.
What if I don't finish? I asked, biting my lip. He spun us around so our backs were to the land and the lake stretched out before us.
You gotta play the mental game too, Shelby. Don't just focus on the physical training. See yourself running. See yourself finishing.
I released him, rolled onto my back, and looked up at the blue, blue sky. I tried to picture it, me being driven over the finish line by a helpful ambulance. No. Me limping and sobbing my way to the finish line. No. Scratch that. I rewound the tape. If I put in the work, if I paced myself and fueled myself properly, I didn't have to limp and sob. I could finish strong. What do you see? He asked, his voice husky, his hands snaking out to hold my ankle. I loved his touch. I loved that I was still sleeping in his bed, but that wasn't all we were doing anymore. I see me, I said, bringing back the picture. Uh-huh. What are you doing? I'm crossing the finish line. Running. Not on a gurney, I added. People are cheering. Someone has a piece of pizza for me. Jonah laughed softly.
How do you feel?
Invincible, I whispered.
Then that's how you'll finish, he promised.
The tips of my fingers brushed his as we floated side by side. Then his fingers were linking with mine.
You can do it, you know, he said.
I'm starting to think I can.
I tell you what, he said, releasing my hand and sinking back into the water. I'll race you back to the dock.
That's not even remotely fair. He raised a hand.
I'll give you a head start. If you finish strong, you get to pick your reward.
My reward? A makeout session with him in the water? An entire 12-pack of Mountain Dew? A whole day without training? More sex? I grinned slowly.
What kind of reward makes you smile like that? He asked.
I want to practice the dirty dancing lift with you in the water, I insisted.
I really wish I didn't know what that was, he sighed.
But you do, and you will, I pressed.
Two attempts, he offered.
Two? It's going to take more than that. Five, I countered.
He eyed me thoughtfully. Five, he nodded.
Ready?
Set?
Go! I dunked him and, with more enthusiasm than actual grace, swam like hell for the dock. I cut through the water, remembering to pop my head up and breathe more often. It helped until I heard his approach behind me. Jonah did everything athletic well, and that included things that happened in the bedroom and the forest and the back seat of his car. The man was a prime physical specimen, and my body was on high alert as he pursued me through the water. I'd been chased before, had been terrified by it, but this kind of a chase brought out something exciting, something primal in me. I felt it click. The effort, the training, the endless research on proper form, and suddenly I was a fish. Jonah was closing in, but the dock was in sight. I shut off my mind and let my body do what it had learned to do. I was the water and the air. I was the sun warm on my back. As the dock speared up in front of me, I reached for it and felt his hand close around my ankle. He yanked me backward, and I sucked in half a lung of lake water in protest. Hey, I sputtered, trying to swipe my bangs out of my eyes and cough up the lake I'd inhaled.
Sorry, Shelbs, I won fair and square, he teased.
I fumed, splashing him in the face. There was nothing fair and square about that. You cheated.
Damn right I did. Had to. You got fast, real fast.
I preened at the praise. I did, didn't I? It all just kicked in at the same time.
Maybe I should chase you the whole way through the triathlon, he mused.
I'd have a heart attack halfway through it, I predicted, though my heart sped up at the thought of Jonah chasing me again. And since you cheated, I demand my prize. He feigned a long-suffering sigh.
Ugh, fine, but don't knee me in the face.
Yay!
Hang on,
he said, grabbing me when I tried to turn away from him.
Let's get closer to shore. I need to be able to stand up.
Oh, right. I plowed through the water toward land, escaping his hands and the heat they scorched me with.
Okay, he said, stopping me in the water. You stay here.
He backed away from me several paces.
You ready?
I was born ready. He rolled his eyes.
Remember, no kicking me in the face,
he called as I started running, or slogging, through the water at him. Kicking wasn't a valid concern. Our first attempt had me kind of lunging at him. His hands slid under my arms and lifted me straight up.
This doesn't feel right, he said under me.
No, I'm supposed to be, like, horizontal. Our bodies should be perpendicular, I deduced.
Right. Okay. So come in faster this next time and I'll grab your waist, he suggested, still grinning up at me.
If you put me down, I will. I expected him to toss me back into the water like a discarded fish, but instead Jonah lowered me slowly into the water. Our slick bodies sliding against each other. Oh, I liked that. A lot. Too much. He liked it too, I noted with a satisfied smirk as I felt the prod of his erection. Okay, faster, I said, as though I hadn't just slid down his body like a stripper pole. Faster, he nodded. I returned to the starting place and hurled myself at him again. The results were the same. This isn't working, I called down from my vantage point above his head.
This looks familiar, he said to my navel.
Let's try going a little deeper. I'll kick off the dock and kind of launch myself at you, I suggested. No kicking, I promised him before he could remind me. The next two attempts were closer. Jonah actually fell over backward, which I considered to be respectable progress in our scientific method. We surfaced, laughing, and this time he scraped my bangs out of my face. One more try, he said with a sexy eyebrow wiggle. I didn't even know eyebrows could be sexy before Jonah. We've got this, I said with confidence. We're a good team. I swam back and assumed the position. Are you ready for me? Because I'm coming in hot. Oh, I'm ready for you, he assured me. And he was. His hands went around my waist, and just like with the swim, my brain shut down and my body took over. I jumped as he lifted, and then I was airborne. Arms spread, core taut. I was flying, and Jonah was holding me up. We're doing it!
We are when we get home.
Scarlet. I'm not sure, but it looks like Shelby and Jonah are practicing the lift from Dirty Dancing off my dock. Cassidy. So cute. Also, we need to rewatch Dirty Dancing immediately. Scarlet. Agreed. Hang on, I have to get a picture of this. We can give it to them at their wedding. Cassidy. I'll go halvesies with you on a frame. 37. Shelby.
That's Scar, Jonah noted when I climbed in the car next to him, soggy on the outside yet physically aroused inside. The plan was to go home, enjoy a quickie, as the cool kids called it, then meet my parents who were pig-sitting for June and GT. He trailed a finger over the jagged mark that scored my upper thigh. It wasn't exactly a question, but I felt like he was hunting for an answer anyway.
It happened a long time ago, I said. Hey, have you seen Gibson lately? Your mom was asking how he was handling this whole Callie Kendall is officially dead thing.
That looks like it was a pretty deep cut, he said casually, completely ignoring my segue.
I, being a trained observer, was instantly suspicious. After I graduated with my bachelor's, I worked in the city as a social worker for a while. One of my house calls didn't go well.
I said it lightly. I'd earned the right to say it lightly, to not tremble every time I thought of what happened in that apartment. Someone did that to you?
His voice was even, but I saw his jaw tighten.
It's a long, boring story, I sighed airily.
So, how is Gibson? Have you talked to him?
Call me misdirection. Ha, nerd joke. He's not answering anyone's calls, as far as I know. We've all taken turns. Probably just holed up with a project. Did it happen the same time as the one on your chest?
Jonah ventured. He'd taken a very careful inventory of my body. First as a trainer, and now as a very thorough lover.
Okay, which one of my big-mouthed family members opened their gigantic mouths? I demanded, dropping the pretense. Your brother. Why don't you want to talk about it with me? He asked with that stupid, sexy grin.
It's not exactly the feel-good story of the year, Jonah.
The truth was, I was proud I'd lived through it. But when people heard what happened, when they saw the scars, they looked at me differently, just like I knew they would if they knew about my diagnosis. I hated the pity, the worry, the whispered concerns.
I'm perfectly capable of taking care of myself, you know.
I snapped at the silent and listening Jonah. I wasn't angry at him specifically, but he was here.
He was handy.
I don't doubt that, he said in that careful, neutral tone.
Yes, you do. Everyone does. I'm too small, too nerdy, always have my nose stuck in a book, too smart for my own good, too much thinking, not enough doing.
Has anyone actually said those things to you? Or are you just putting words in people's mouths? He asked.
I crossed my arms over my chest, the wet of my bathing suit bleeding through my t-shirt.
Plenty of people have said them, and more have thought them. For instance, if I'd been more assertive about seducing you, you wouldn't have dragged your feet for so damn long.
You said damn.
You're damn right I did.
My temper was a hibernating dragon. It rarely reared its fiery head, but when it did, watch out.
That's how mad I am right now. What was GT's reasoning for telling you? Worrying that I couldn't take care of myself? Hoping you'll step up to be my new babysitter?
I realize you're the one with a psychology degree and an impending doctorate in social work, so I probably don't need to point out the fact that your anger seems a little reactionary, like I just pushed a button or something.
Gritting my teeth, I let out a throaty grumble. The man had a point. It wasn't exactly his fault that he'd stumbled across the one thing guaranteed to piss me off.
You want to know why I didn't tell my family about this whole ankylosing spondylitis thing?
Yes, unless that's a separate conversation, and then I'd like to finish this one first.
When I was attacked, they descended on me. They moved into my apartment. They cooked my meals, did my grocery shopping, drove me to doctor's appointments. It was like I was a kid again, like they didn't trust me to handle anything on my own. You know what happened when GT blew out his knee? I asked.
What?
Sure, Mom and Dad flew out for his surgery, but they didn't smother him to death. They even stayed in a hotel, treated it like a visit, because he wasn't me.
Jonas smirked.
What? I demanded. What's that look for?
You're upset because you got more attention than your brother. That your parents love you so much they can't help but worry about you after you were attacked and stabbed.
The easiness went out of him, and he was suddenly gripping the wheel as if he'd like to break it in half.
Injuring your knee on a football field and almost getting killed are two entirely different things, and you are more than smart enough to know that.
I knew he had a point. I'd made the same point to myself on several occasions. But sometimes it didn't stop the rush of emotions.
You know what I think?
I'm sure you'll tell me anyway.
Even angry, I was maybe the tiniest bit curious about what he thought.
I think that attack made you doubt yourself. You went in there thinking you could handle it, and then you couldn't contain the situation. You couldn't fix it, and that broke a piece off you. It's a piece that gets broken off everyone. But you're using it to think you can't do other things.
Like what?
Like deal with your disease. Like finish a triathlon. Like write your goddamn dissertation. You think if you just put everything off by getting more information, doing more research, that you'll never have to actually see something through. And if you don't finish something, you won't be disappointed in yourself again.
You know what I think about that, Jonah Bodine?
My voice was entering the Billy Ray howling octave.
I live for your opinion,
he said sarcastically as he pulled into our driveway.
You are absolutely, without a doubt, 100% right.
Just like that, the anger burned itself out, leaving behind a lighter, brighter me. Jonah cracked a grin.
Have you ever thought about getting into counseling? I asked.
He laughed.
I'm a personal trainer. It's the professional equivalent of a bartender.
I don't mean to say this in an offensive way, I preempted. But you are way more than just a pretty face and a six-pack. You are an excellent listener and keenly insightful. And I think I like your brain even more than I like your very nice body.
To be clear, I like your body very, very much. Sounds like I'm going to be a very memorable summer fling. Do you think you'll tell your grandkids about the hot, smart guy who talked sense into you?
Come sit with Grandma, little Shelby the Third, and let me tell you all about the boy I fell for a summer, I said, affecting an elderly tone.
Jonah reached out, squeezed my knee.
I care about you, Shelby. Your family cares about you. That's not a bad thing.
I feel like if they're worrying about me, that I'm not proving that I can take care of myself. I confessed. Families worry, regardless of how well you can take care of yourself. And sometimes we all need a little help. I unsnapped my seatbelt.
Speaking of families, your mom went on a date with Jimmy Bob Prosser, a proper one, with dinner and candles last night. And she's hoping that you'll fall in love, get married, and give her some grandbabies. I left him sitting behind the wheel, speechless, and went inside to let Billy Ray out.
38. Jonah.
Are you sure you don't want to join us? Mom asked me under the protective arm of Jimmy Bob Prosser as they escorted me toward the fire escape. They'd invited me over for dinner, which I'd declined since I wanted to make sure Shelby was eating something healthy tonight. So we'd decided on drinks on the rooftop deck of the hardware store. Jimmy Bob lived in the apartment above the store, the back of which opened onto the first floor roof overlooking the rear parking lot. It was a cool, functional spot with some camp chairs and a folding table. I could tell by the way my mom scanned the deck while we talked that she was mentally redecorating the space. I'm sure, I told her. You two have fun with the banjo trio.
Jimmy Bob's been taking banjo lessons from Mayor Hornsblatt, my mother said proudly.
I made a mental note to remind her of that particular statement later and added to the list of things said only in Bootleg Springs.
Really? That's great, Jimmy Bob, I said.
The big bear of a man blushed pink, his barn-broad shoulders hunching.
It's just a fun hobby, he said. Drive safe now, you hear?
Will do, Jimmy Bob, I said, stepping onto the fire escape. My mom gave me a sunny smile, which I returned. She'd been cagey about when she was returning to Jetty Beach. She'd had a month's worth of vacation days saved up from all the years she'd never taken one, and since the diner where she worked back in Jetty Beach was closed for renovations, there seemed to be no rush to get back, not when she was enjoying her own summer fling.
Have a nice night, y'all, I said. Thanks for the beer.
Shit, I'd said y'all. Bootleg Springs claimed another victim. I got in my car and headed in the direction of home. My windows were down, letting the evening summer breeze into the car. Fireflies lit up and snuffed out, working out their own kind of Morse code on the humid night air. The crickets and tree frogs were competing for loudest celebration in the woods that flashed past my headlights. I tapped my hands on the wheel in time to the Darius Rucker song I'd cranked and turned into the gravel drive of the little yellow house. I felt good, better than good, especially when I thought of Shelby waiting for me at home. Shelby. Just thinking about her made me smile, I thought, as the back of the house came into view. I knew it was a summer thing, a fling. And maybe that was part of this feeling. We were free to have fun, to just enjoy. We'd developed our own routine, waking early before any obligations, spending the first quiet moments of the day naked and playful, learning each other's bodies. Most mornings we worked out together, and in the evenings I cooked and Shelby cleaned while we filled each other in on our days. Billy Ray at our feet or in our laps. In a sense, we were playing house without the strain of commitments and responsibilities, of expectations and futures. I wouldn't mind summer nights like this in my future, coming home to Shelby. More nights tangled up in the sheets, eating cold leftovers naked in bed while we laughed and talked. I hoped that was the agenda for tonight. I wouldn't mind if it was on the agenda every night. The thought, fleeting though it was, caught my attention. Could we find a way to make our own endless summer? Was that even a possibility? Was it something that I really wanted? There were cars here, I noted, pulling around the front of the house. My plans for a quiet, naked night evaporated. I got out from behind the wheel to Billy Ray's excited yips.
The front porch was dressed for fancy. Candles winked in the darkness, and a string of lights glowed on the railing, illuminating a linen-covered table set for two, a bottle of champagne in an ice bucket, and... was that a string quartet? Yep, it looked as though Shelby had raided the Bootleg Springs High School band. The kids were dressed in the teenage version of fancy in jeans and black t-shirts. The cellist had braces. I took a tentative step forward, and the quartet began to play a quiet country, of course, ballad. But what caught and held my attention was Shelby. She stood on the top step in a pink party dress with a low scoop neck and a full skirt. She was smiling ear to ear, hands clasped in front of her. "What's all this?" I asked, climbing the steps to her. She leaned in and gave me a soft kiss. I tried to be mindful of our underage audience, but I still had a brain full of naked plans. Her lips against mine, the soft brush of her body, the night air filled with nature's song. It went straight to my head. I wouldn't need the champagne. I was already buzzing.
"You're not the only one who wants to be memorable," she said, pulling back with a grin.
The woman could light up a room or an entire front yard with that smile. "Shelby, there isn't a chance on this earth that I won't be remembering you when I'm 80 and leading a chair yoga class at the retirement home," I teased.
"Just making sure," she said.
Billy Ray scrambled against my leg, demanding his share of the attention. I leaned down to scoop him up, but couldn't resist giving Shelby another kiss. Pretty in pink, her dark bangs framed those wide eyes that sparkled like all the joy in the world lived inside her. She took my breath away.
"Come on, dinner's ready,"
she said, leading me to the table. I gave the dog a snuggle and a kiss before setting him down in front of his food and water dishes. A family dinner, I realized.
"You cooked?"
I asked, trying to hide the apprehension.
"I ordered out,"
Shelby said smugly. She pointed to the heaping Cobb salads on the plates.
"Hi, guys,"
I said, giving the quartet a little wave. Fingers on strings and bows wiggled back. I sat and admired the view as Shelby adjusted her skirts across from me. "You're a hell of a girl, Shelby Thompson."
"Thank you for noticing, Jonah Bodine."
She batted her lashes coyly, and I laughed. We dined al fresco to live music, and I filled her in on the latest in my mother's relationship.
"It sounds serious," she mused over her glass of champagne.
"It's just a fling," I predicted. "My mom isn't going to uproot her entire life to take a chance on love in Bootleg Springs."
"In that case, to summer flings,"
she said, raising her glass to mine.
"To summer flings,"
I echoed. Later that night, I tipped the teenage musicians $20 each and then guided Shelby upstairs. And when I settled over her, into her, with the flavor of champagne between us, I wondered again if there was more to this, to us, than just one summer. Question:
in what ways do you interact with your neighbors outside of societal norms?
Walter Nagley:
I play the violin on their front porches while they're on a date. Thanks for the $20.
39, Shelby. Next time you need a favor, can you please make it an easy one that actually pays off in the end? Amanda huffed into my ear. It was a hot July morning. The park was still decked out from last week's holiday festivities. The breathtaking engagement ring Jameson had slid on Leah Mae's finger this weekend hadn't lost its sparkle, and I was hustling my wayward puppy through a series of training exercises on our walk through town that he was all too happy to ignore. I promise you I'll never ask for another favor again, I said, untangling Billy Ray's leash from my legs. Leash manners and walking etiquette were not his strong suit. He'd just gotten done wrapping me up with a cocker spaniel named Linda in the lakefront park when Amanda called. I'm afraid you might have wasted this one, she said. I heard her bite into something crisp and crunchy. Lunchtime for most social workers happened on the fly. No cases? I asked, disappointed but not surprised. There was one. I perked up and towed Billy Ray toward a park bench, wishing I had a notebook on me. Jonah and I were meeting up after his personal training session to swap dog parenting duties, so I hadn't thought to bring anything with me besides a collapsible water dish for the puppy. You're kidding me, I said. I felt the interest hum to life inside me. New information. Something no one else had. It was a researcher's fantasy. Unsubstantiated claim in Henrico County. It's an old file, so it looks kind of like someone forgot to enter 90% of the information, including what the initial complaint was. Unfortunately, par for the course, since the move was made to electronic records, and it was sealed. That explained why it had never made the news. Does it say who reported it? I asked, drumming my fingers against my lips. The puppy sniffed after a butterfly and then lifted his leg on a pine cone. There's a name, but no title. I'll send you the particulars. My contact copied me on it, so I'll email you the file. Not much there. It was from back in 98. Odds are it was an elementary teacher, maybe a school nurse, or someone along those lines. Thanks for the info, Amanda. I owe you big time. I don't know what you're up to, but be careful, she cautioned me. I started dialing the second the call disconnected. Hello. Hey, June, it's Shelby. I ascertained that fact from my caller ID, she said. You tracked down the fake Callie, didn't you? I asked. Yes. Is that all? I'm occupied teaching Catherine to fetch. How would you feel about taking a road trip with me today? No, thank you. I prefer to stay here with my pig. What if you could bring her along? I'll bring Billy Ray. Where are we going? We're tracking down two people who might have information about Callie Kendall, I told her. I assume you mean information besides the fact that she is deceased, she asked. Yes, I promised. I think we could find something that might point suspicion away from Jonah Bodine Sr. June sighed. Fine, but I'll want lunch, a turkey sandwich, Turkey Tuesday. Callie Kendall was dead, but there were still questions. And if I could get a few of them answered for Jonah and the rest of the Bodines, we'd all sleep better. After another phone call, a handful of texts, and a stop at the pop-in for gas and provisions, I swung by June's house. June hefted the haltered Catherine up and into the back seat. Catherine oinked a greeting at Billy Ray, who bravely licked her face and then cowered in the corner. June was wearing a ball cap featuring the logo of GT's team rivals. Beneath the brim was a pair of movie star huge sunglasses. Did GT see that hat? I asked. She shook her head. It's part of my disguise. I borrowed it from Opal Bodine. If we're tracking down the fake Callie Kendall, I've ripped hair from this woman's head. It would be safer for all of us if she did not recognize me. Smart, I said, typing in the first address into the GPS program. First stop, Abby Gilbert. What are we talking to her about? Is there a requirement for good cop, bad cop? I think I could perform an effective bad cop, June said. We're asking her why the Kendalls believed that she was their daughter. She pursed her lips under the glasses. Do you believe they knew Abby was not their daughter? It's crossed my mind. Then why would they give her an apartment? Why would they publicly claim her as their daughter? She asked. That's what we're going to find out. I pointed to the bag at her feet. There's a turkey sandwich in there for you. Turkey Tuesday. Abby had been booted from her upscale Philadelphia apartment financed by the Kendalls. She now lived in a squat gray brick building on the outskirts of Baltimore. The neighborhood was made up entirely of run-down row homes and graffitied convenience stores. Fast food bags and the cardboard from six packs littered the sidewalks and gutters. It didn't feel dangerous, just well past its prime, like its residents had given up on keeping up appearances. I put the car in park and cranked up the air conditioning. "Do you want to wait here with the kids?" I asked June. She looked torn, peering into the back seat where her beloved Catherine was enjoying a snack of lettuce and pellets. "I should accompany you," she decided reluctantly. We locked the car and crossed the road to the apartment building. A. Gilbert was listed above apartment B3. I pressed the buzzer and waited. There were no security cameras here, and some of the mailboxes inside the foyer had their doors broken off. It did not give off a homey vibe. I buzzed again. Waited. "Perhaps she is at work," June suggested. I shook my head. "Cassidy says there's no job on record for her." "My sister gave you this address?" June asked, surprised. Cassidy Tucker was straight as an arrow, a good guy to the bone. She took the law and its rules very seriously. "Of course not," I scoffed. "I had Leah May use her super social media sleuthing powers to track her down. I just asked Cassidy if she knew if Abby was employed." "She must have been suspicious," June insisted. On cue, her phone rang and Cassidy's name scrolled across the screen. "Maybe don't answer that until we're on our way home," I suggested. "I believe that is the correct course of action." I stabbed the buzzer for B2 belonging to an M. McManus. We waited another minute, the hot sun baking us on the sidewalk. "Maybe we should go back to the car. We have another stop to make. We could try Abby again afterward." June gave the front door a hard tug, and we both watched, bemused, as the door opened. "Some security system," I muttered. We took the stairs to the second floor. The paint on the walls and railing was peeling, and the carpet had bare spots, but overall it was clean. B3 was the second door on the left. I held my ear to the door and listened. "What are you doing?" June asked at normal volume. I eased back and shushed her. "I'm trying to see if she's in there. She might not be answering the buzzer because she doesn't want to talk." "This is taking too long. I would like to get back to my pig." She reached around me and wrapped her knuckles on the door. "Abby Gilbert, I would like to speak with you." A dark head poked out of the door across the hall.
"You're going to have to yell a hell of a lot louder than that." June took a breath.
"Abby Gilbert!" I cut her off with a hand on her arm. "That's not what you meant, is it?" I asked the woman. Her jet black hair was styled in a pristine bowl cut. She was wearing a purple and yellow house coat and slippers that looked older than me. "The poor girl," the woman tut-tutted. "Couldn't catch a break. Said her boyfriend broke up with her and she lost her job in Baltimore." June opened her mouth to argue, but I squeezed her arm. "Do you know where we could find Abby?" I asked. The woman frowned.
"That's what the police called her, too."
"The police?" June asked.
"We knew her as Ashley, not Abby. But whoever she was hit by a car and killed last Thursday. Hit and run on her way home from the liquor store," the neighbor said, shaking her head sadly. "Like I said, the girl couldn't catch a break."
40. Shelby.
"I did not anticipate that," June said when we returned to the car. Catherine danced on dainty hooves in the back seat, thrilled at June's return. Billy Ray was too busy napping under a